Okay, let's get started. So change of plans. I realized that I was going to talk about web frameworks and SQL, NoSQL this week, but I realized that's good for you to know, but that has no direct relevance to what you're building. So let me do security this week. And then I'll do that. Huh? What?
You're allowed to do security this week.
Okay. I'm used to putting security at the end because normally integrating into the class doesn't seem as important.
Wait,
but it's actually
you want to do relevant things.
Well, if you don't think security is relevant to web applications, you haven't been paying much attention, considering web security is like the biggest security vulnerability set out there.
Right, so the standard that things are insecure. Stop trying to break the standard, man.
Well established.
What did I say? I like to tilt at windmills. So I'm going to... So I'm going to ask you a basic question. Why are web applications insecure? You now are familiar with the basic technology of a web application. You are building a web application. What's messed up? Why is this thing more, you just say, well, programs are insecure. And to a first approximation, you're right. But web applications are particularly nasty. So why? No, that's the problem.
People are smart.
People are people.
People are really stupid. Some people are really smart.
Yeah. No, it's not a question of being smart or not smart. I mean, the thing you have to understand about security, especially in the web realm, is not a... It sneaks up on you. So let's start giving reasons here. So you're saying there's lots of places. So, okay. Opportunities for code injection. This we should expand on because this is a big one. There's lots of places where code can get injected. There's different kinds of code that can get injected, and then get injected at different places. So, this is what I expect. What else?
It's very hard to restrict access to your web app.
Okay, so there's input from untrusted sources. Well, everyone can access your app.
So, wide access.
Can't trust the client.
Untrusted client. Running your code. That's a weird thing about web apps, is that you take a big chunk of your application, an increasingly large chunk of your application, and you put it right in the hands of the attacker. So it's not just that the attacker can give you bad input. They can manipulate your code directly. And there are threat models where you think you're trying to crack a program that has digital rights. Digital rights management or something, and there's other kind of things, but for most of the kind of apps, for classic network servers and stuff, you don't have this kind of thing because the code is all on the server. You just send it, weird input. Here, the code is on the client. Full inspection, fully modifiable. Yes?
Full inspection, it's not even, if it's JavaScript, it's not even sent compiled, it's sent human readable.
Running your code in source form. you can try to minify it in other things, but they're gonna. It's not too hard to unminify things. Yes.
There's a lot of proxies in between you and the user.
Proxies.
Like there's a server, there's a browser, there's the machine itself, which is the ISP, and there's your web host. There's a lot of places where someone can gain access.
So you're saying that, so there is the issue of untrusted network communications. It is possible for folks to get in the middle and stick things into your web app. That is true. But if you use SSL or something, then you mostly alleviate that. But
most people don't use SSL.
Yes, most people don't use SSL. So
that's true. Opportunities. Or intruder in the middle.
Intruder in the middle attacks. Yeah. Okay. Other things? So, here is a security problem that actually should be pretty clear to you if you think about what we talked about in this class, but probably isn't. Because Lord knows a lot of other people have a take on it. Which is your web page
as a context. So you have a web page here.
What goes inside of a web page?
So there goes your code. There goes user's data.
What else goes in there?
Ads.
Okay, so video.
Google Analytics.
Well, that's ads.
Well, monitoring. Well, analytics, we're saying. Yeah, but basically, it's spying on it.
What else? So there's the,
then there's the whole, that's a separate issue. So there's browse, plugins,
so strictly speaking, what do you define as what?
There's a whole classes like Java applet plugins, Flash plugins, those kind of things have had lots of security vulnerabilities. But strictly speaking, those aren't vulnerabilities in
a web application. The way those are exploited is by you visiting a bad website. And then that website then sticks something into your browser and then takes it over. So it's more of an attack via the web of your machine. And I'm really here more thinking about is why are web applications insecure?
So this is all kind of part of it, but not quite our concern. I'm more concerned with this. Now, how is all of this stuff, you might have a Twitter feed, you might have a Facebook, connect something. How are all these interacting inside of this page?
They all are embedded via JavaScript. They all have JavaScript, how have we restricted access? What part of specifically, in the context of JavaScript, what variables does it have access to? What functions do each of these have access to? They have access to all the globals, which leads to everything else. So you do have private things for individual modules. You can define that, and that will stay relatively secure within that context. But you can override any of these folks have access to the global document scope. Thus, they can change any global binding, any of them. So the whole thing we were talking about, like paranoid JavaScript coding, is not completely crazy. You do have to do that. But actually, that's not enough. Let's say you load an ad from Microsoft, and you load a video from Google, from YouTube. What do you... Do they have to be nice to each other? No. Not at all. Let's say you manage to take over the Google Analytics framework. How much of the internet could you spy on? How much of the internet could you censor? Not all of it, but a lot of it. A very large part of it. Anyone who uses those things, because Google Analytics JavaScript is included in so many pages. That JavaScript has no fundamental restrictions on what it can do to the page. It can edit the DOM, change the page. It can look at anything in the DOM, bring in additional code, overload other variables to change the behavior of the other code that's in the page. It's all one scope. You now have learned enough JavaScript, you should realize how feasible all of this is. So just give you an idea. So huge problems in the client. It's all mixed together in a big mash, and how do you keep that mess from going? And this mess percolates over to your server, because this is what's feeding inputs to it. And even though you might say the client is untrusted, it's your code. You go, of course I trust my code. I put my code in the browser. It'll do the right thing. It'll give me the right input. It's very hard for programmers to get their head around the idea that, oh, wow, the code I just sent there could be messed with in a variety of ways. So it's my code, but it's not my code. Developers all the time get screwed up on this. And a good discipline for how to do it, we'll talk about some client-side things that could potentially help your server trust your code a little more. But it's just a fundamental issue with the way things are. So let's talk about injection. So in other words, when you're designing your app, what sort of things are you going to try to watch out for so you don't look like a complete idiot? So what are the kinds of attacks? Do you know any names or attack types?
SQL.
So there's SQL injection. Shell injection. Yeah, that's not a common one, but I was thinking more cross-site scripting. How many of you have heard of cross-site scripting? Oh wow. Not many. This is a huge one. Cross-site request forgery. So this is normally done with XSS. Site. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. See, and that's actually the key thing you should know about terminology in the web security space is it's crap. It's all confusing. Like, for example, what's normally classified as cross-site scripting cannot be cross-site at all and can involve no scripting. So you should just go on like, So let me try to get you some other ways of thinking about this. Which is really, so this is code injection. That's what that is. Now, if you're writing a C program, code injection takes the form of you overflowing a buffer or something and then overwriting the stack, and now you can inject machine code into your application. That's for C. You can in principle do that to a web application. You could do that on the server side and take over the server, or you could do it on the client side and take over the browser. But that's not, while that is definitely possible and it's something you should kind of care about, it's mostly the problem of the people who made your web server software and your web client software. You can't do too much about that as a web application developer, at least not directly. But this stuff is stuff you messed up. It's your fault. If you're making a web app, when this stuff happens, you generally did it. Or it might be a library or something else you use, but more generally it's you did it. So, and the web is, as you said, there's lots of opportunities for code injection. And that's because there's lots of languages and there's lots of input. Basically, any language you have could potentially inject it, because almost all those languages exist to process input from the user in some way. And so when the user takes that input and it mixes with your code, if you don't do things right, you get confused. So I think SQL injection is probably the easiest to see. Anyone heard of Johnny Drop Tables? Bobby Drop Tables. So, what is that talking about here? What is this? So can you explain that to me?
The idea of using SQL commands in a text field. So the text field then escapes the text and applies the command to the database.
So you have a general command of So we've got a general kind of, in your code, what does it look like when you talk to the database? What's the kind of interface? Like, there's a bunch of interfaces for talking to databases. You've seen some of them. But one very simple low-level thing is something like send SQL or send it, or send to the DB or something. And then what you give it is a string. Because the database takes a string as input. You might say, oh, my thing's a little better. Because it doesn't take one string. What it does is it takes two strings. This is supposed to be the command and the arguments. But what's going to happen when it gets sent to the database? Those get concatenated together and sent on. So this is a convenience function, because this could be a constant variable you have of whatever command you want, and then this is something else. And what does SQL let you do? Like most languages, does one string have to represent one command? No. We have things like semicolons to allow you to put more than one command on the same line. So what you do then is, what if this user input has a semicolon inside of it, and then it has another command? You now have given the database two commands. You thought, well, I told it something specific. I had a select operation here.
I want to select certain tables, and then here, after the semicolon, I put a drop command, which means delete a table. It's like... So, but you see this basic structure. This is where you get in trouble, is that your code is taking user input and taking that input and sending it to another parser, another command interpreter. And if you look at the structure of your web application, you realize interpreters are everywhere. I mean, there's the interpreters in the browser. There's the one in your main code. There's the one in the database. Even inside your code, you might, like, regular expressions is a command language. Given sufficiently powerful regular expressions, they can actually execute shell commands on their own. Generally, web ones don't let you do that. Perl and stuff lets you do some really weird things. But wherever there's a parser, there's danger. To give you an idea of this, for a long time, people knew that processing strings in C was a problem, and that could, you know, you overwrote a string buffer, then you would have some problem. Did you know that printf is dangerous?
Really?
Printf. Why is printf dangerous? Partially, yes, but also, so that's part of it. But let's say you do printf, and you just have a... What's wrong with that?
S is a
pointer. Let's say S is a string. Will this work? Yeah, in general, this will work. But the first argument to printf is a description of what you're supposed to do. Like, the right way, if this was a user-supplied string, the right way to do this is to do... percent S, I think?
Yeah.
Maybe backslash, yep. And then S. By putting this in here, now the printf has a parser. It has its own command language where it goes through the string and looks for percentages and does things. And some of those things involve accessing random bits of memory. That's what the string is. Some of them involve even changing memory because you can implement counters and have them count things as you enter them out. There's read and there's write in this percent command language. It's a parser.
I didn't realize printf could write.
You don't normally do that, but you know, they added some extra options.
Writes.
Well, yes, that's true. It writes to a buffer, right? But the idea is that even inside, you can write to other things, too. So, this is called a format string vulnerability. Now, it's very easy to get lost in looking at computer security terminology and looking at, oh, there's format string vulnerabilities. Oh, there's SQL injection. It's like parsers. It's all parsers. You're giving data to a parser that is untrusted, and the parser's doing something, and the parser's too powerful. You give untrusted data to a parser that's too powerful, who the heck knows what it does? Because in general, the powerful parsers do have more functionality in them than you know about. And that's why you have to be, this is where the paranoia comes in. Because even today, you think the parser doesn't have much functionality, some programmer is going to come along and add some command to it, add some features to it, and then next year, your application wasn't vulnerable, is now vulnerable. So why do we keep doing parsers? Don't programmers know? Why do we keep doing, because parsers are so powerful. But they're powerful not just for you, but for the attacker. That's the basic pattern. So when you're looking at when you're designing your server application, you have to realize whenever you take an input from any external source, that input, and then do something interesting with it, it's probably going to come across a parser. And when it comes across that parser, if you haven't very carefully checked it, an attacker is going to take control of the parser with the input you passed on. So now you should be going like, darn it. And if you look at your code, you're probably going to find some place where you sent some input from a user and you did not check it. Because it's the easiest thing to do. And this is an open research question. How do you structure programs so that you don't run into these security problems? I mean, the problem is it means taking away power from the programmer. You actually have to make APIs less powerful. You have to make them less flexible. Because it's the very flexibility that's shooting you in the foot. It's the fact that this senddb command can send any darn database command. You instead want to make this into like 20 commands. But then you have to make it so that the database, how do you control the database in such a way that's only going to get, how do both sides agree that we're actually just doing select commands and not doing drop commands? This is a research problem. This is not solved. And how to address that? I mean, I could. If you want to do a PhD in this area, I can have a little chat with you. But it's a big problem. So as a developer, you just have to know that it's a minefield. You're probably going to mess up. The best you can hope for is to make your mess ups fewer than the other guys, so that anyone trying to find a flaw in your program is going to have a harder time of it. Because it's only a question of harder versus easier. It's not a question of no vulnerabilities. Your program will have, if your program is more than trivially complex, it will have vulnerabilities. Sorry. I don't care how good of a programmer you are. The best programs I've ever seen, people who live and breathe security, their programs have flaws. It's the human condition. So, but let me give you some strategies of how you deal with this. So this kind of goes very well with, so regular expressions are normally thought of as a tool in your toolbox for doing this, and they are kind of. They're also a good way to make you think you've solved the problem and you haven't. So what we're talking about is the problem of input sanitization. So what does it mean to sanitize your input? I mean, do you have a disease? Antibacterial soap?
Basically clean it up, like detect these type of SQL injections, for example, like if there are any semicolons, if there are any.
Okay. So now you're thinking on the right lines and the wrong lines. Okay. So the right thing is you want to remove anything from the input that could be dangerous. The problem is, in general, you don't know all the things that are dangerous. You think, wait, it's an SQL command. If I just remove the semicolons, I'll be fine. Are you sure? You sure there's no other way to break it? Maybe they could stick a new line in there. Did you think of that?
So I guess really it's more, instead of trying to weed out what's wrong, you only take it so that it only accepts what you know is going to work.
So now we're talking, that's exactly the questions you need to look. So there's whitelists and blacklists. Which means, do you look for patterns of bad things? Or do you look for patterns of good things? The idea is if you have a blacklist, it's like who am I going to let in this room? A blacklist would say, okay, let me make a list of bad people in the world that I don't want to let into this room. So I list all the known serial killers. I list all the people I didn't get along with in second grade. I make a list of all these people. That's my blacklist. A whitelist would be the enrollment of this class.
everyone who's actually enrolled in this class is allowed in, and then maybe include the TAs. Now, might I allow other people into this room? Like, maybe I should let
and
my wife
audited?
In?
And get audited?
Yeah, get audited. Yeah. I mean, this is, you can let, it, I mean, I could say, well, if my wife walks in the room, is she kind of allowed? Well, kind of, yeah. But should she be showing up here normally? Probably not. So there's all this kind of...
List.
So this is one problem when you start doing these sort of things. It's like, what about those things that normally shouldn't be there, but shouldn't be? When you go for a whitelist, you often are cutting things off, and you're making it too strict. And that's actually why typically programmers don't like to use whitelists, because they're inherently less flexible. You have to go through and say, here are all the things that are okay. Like, for example, let's say you're inputting someone's name. What if you say the name should consist of a first name and a last name? And you say, okay, it's out of space. What if someone has three names? What if they have four? What if they have five names? Let's say you've given a really long buffer. You have room for them. How do you account for which ones? Now, it might be very... So you say, well, as opposed to specifying exactly what a name looks like, I don't know what a name looks like. And if I do want to know what a name looks like, now I've got, I probably messed it up. So let me instead go and just try to figure out all the characters that will mess up an SQL command.
Are there any sanitization parsers, perhaps?
Yes, there are.
But then it's a parser.
Yeah. You're thinking right. So this is where libraries come in. Like when I was saying, how do you take a date? So... Like jQuery UI has all these built-in mechanisms for doing input sanitization. This is why I say don't write your own input sanitization mechanisms. Because if you want to do a whitelist, whitelists with appropriate generality are hard. Blacklists with appropriate generality are hard. You mess up a blacklist, you don't notice until your application gets attacked. You mess with a whitelist, you see the problem in errors because this user tries doing something and customers complain to you. See, that's the other reason. Blacklists, in the common case, fail very nicely. If you aren't under attack, a blacklist is much safer. But a whitelist is much more secure. So what will you most programmers go with? This will work. It's just like saying every file has you have read-write access to every file in your system. Those file permissions get in the way. Now, why do I need to restrict it? And if I have access to everything, my web application should have access to everything. Because otherwise, I get these permission errors. My application doesn't work. And I want to get rid of those permission errors. So I'll make everything world-writable. Permission error is gone.
Run your server as root.
Yeah, run it as root.
Might as well make them executable while you're at
it. Yeah, make them all executable. It's always easier to remove restrictions. It makes more things work.
Makes everything work.
Trouble is, it makes the attacks work too. So it's security is this unforgiving discipline in the sense of if you do everything right, you make more work for yourself, and you never notice the difference. Except that someone doesn't call you in the middle of the night and say, damn it, our system just got compromised.
Even then, it still happens.
Yes, and even then, it still happens. Even if you did your job perfectly right, someone else messed it up, and that messed up your application. So.
And you get a bad performance from this.
And you get a bad performance. So, use whitelists, avoid blacklists. So this means when you're trying to do SQL, don't list the bad things. Instead, have a specific pattern for exactly what it is you want. Use other people's patterns that have been well tested, because when you're trying to make the whitelist, you're going to mess it up. Expect to debug whitelists. Expect whitelists to be painful to implement. So use someone else's. So,
notice this applies everywhere. It's like when you say send DB, this could have been, you know, to an SQL database, and so you had SQL commands. What if this now all of a sudden goes to Mongo? Now all of a sudden, you're potentially sending arbitrary JavaScript to MongoDB server. Now, I think in general, the NoSQL databases are actually a little bit less vulnerable because you don't normally talk to them via an via just arbitrary strings. You don't give them string commands. You're a little bit more of an API. And so there's a clearer separation between the code and the data. But it depends. And some of these NoSQL things just have restricted command sets.
But I mean, even correlational databases isn't doing it like that bad idea anyways. I mean, why should you send the actual string? You send the time tense, and then on the back end, the string is generated like random.
Right. So like there's stored SQL
Procedures,
and so then you aren't actually sending the full SQL command, you just send the parameters for it, and then gets processed there. So exactly, that is like the right way of doing things. But again, I'm not going to try telling you about all the right way of doing things, because they're very, very specific, and it depends on every little package. That's what I'm trying to say. You should say, is there a parser? Am I sending data directly to a parser? You know, how much interpretation is happening of the string? Is it taking it? Is it breaking it up into pieces and then interpreting the parts of it? Should look, uh-oh. That's dangerous.
But is this actually common? Like, do people do a lot of, create SQL on the front end and just send it as
it? SQL injection is a ridiculously common vulnerability.
It's really easy to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's happened all the time. I mean, the newer libraries and stuff, but I mean, this is just, it happens. Should it happen? No. If they knew it had a clue, no. But it's so easy. It's just a string. You just put it in. You just interpolate and send the whole string, and then you're done. Like, oh, look, I know SQL. Mm-hmm. I'm making my own commands. Aren't I fancy? You know, that's the trouble with all these sort of things. You're not going to get nailed by something that's really, really complicated. It's because you forgot to do something, you go like, why did I do that? And it's because you were coding at 2 in the morning and you wanted to get the code working, and you did it the way that required the fewest lines of code, which worked and which was insecure. That's how these bugs get introduced. It's not because programmers don't know about it. They do. So random databases. So now, where does this come in for a node application if you're not talking to the database? Because you're taking input from get and put, and get and post, and all of they're coming there. You got these option fields. That's input. What do you do with it? Where do you send it? Oh, you start creating data structures with it. You might say, oh, I can make this really elaborate thing by just taking a JSON object that's created on the client and just interpreting it in my server. I'll just load the JSON. Right? Because it'll be exactly what I want, as opposed to loading a JSON object. And now, the classic way you can interpret JSON is, well, hey, it's just JavaScript. I could call eval on it. If you call eval on it, now you've run arbitrary code in your node server. If you use a JSON parsing function, at least you haven't gotten arbitrary code, you've just gotten data, but you potentially have unarbitrary data. You have to filter it. You have to sanitize it. What's the best strategy if you're getting JSON from the client? When you get JSON from a client, what should you do with it?
Replace it with an empty string and continue.
So what's a JSON coming from the client? JSON is this big blob of text formatted as a JavaScript object. On your server, you'll want to... So the first thing, you've got this JSON object. You've got to parse it. Sorry, you've got to parse it. If you use... Use the JSON parser. So now you have a bunch of variables. Now, if you do this right, all the things that got parsed will be in a certain scope. They won't pollute your general scope. They'll be all part of a certain object. So that's good. But now, do you pull things out of it and just directly put it into your global scope? No. Everything in there is untrusted. Use the parser. Sanitize every object before passing to a parser. They should look at this and go like, I do? That sounds annoying. That sounds like a lot of work. It is!
It's also a lot of secure.
Yeah, but you see, this is just like... But I put my code on the other side so I wouldn't have to do this. Basically, all the input checking you do on the client, you have to do it again on the server. And more. Because then you can give errors. If you do it on the client as well, because that way you can give immediate feedback to the client to say, hey, you didn't enter a proper email address. But the server has to check it. Now, if it's just user data and you're just storing this, you might have to do less processing. But you have to, say, what am I going to do with this data? Am I just storing it, or am I going to do other things with it? You have to validate it. And how exactly you validate it depends on what the data is. But you now have to think really hard about what exactly that data is supposed to look like. You have to have a... So this is when we talk about databases and data models and other things. That's actually tools for helping deal with this. Because if you do it right, you throw this sort of stuff at a database, and the database goes, oh, that doesn't look right. That doesn't follow my proper business rules. I'm not going to incorporate that data in there because it's weird in some way. So databases aren't just a vulnerability. They're potentially a tool for helping you deal with this. But sanitizing that data that you get from the client, I can just tell you that you have to do it. And if you give me specific examples, I can tell you, specific things to do. But it's not a, this is what you do. It's not a kind of data. It's an ad hoc basis. I mean, hopefully now you're getting some sympathy for all the web programmers that have gotten, gotten owned, yeah. Because this is all code, and what will this code do if you mess it up? This code will break your app. And if you remove this code, your app works. That right there should make you go like, oh, man. You mean I remove lines and my code works better? It produces fewer errors? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Until it will give fewer errors, especially when the attacker takes over your app. Get any errors at all? This is the thing I hate about security. When I start telling people how to program securely, I just start telling them things, and I'm going like, you can't do it. You can try. You can kind of do it, but you're not going to do it.
But then, isn't it in a way getting worse? I mean, on one hand, you want to make things easier, especially by implementing APIs and work functions, storing stuff on the client side, etc. But isn't that makes it worse?
It makes it much worse. Because the next piece I have to talk to you about is so basically server-side security. So to a first approximation, server-side security is input validation. You have to make sure the input you get from the client, get from outside sources, is properly, before you send it to any parser, is appropriately sanitized, which ideally means you have some sort of whitelist. If you can't figure out what the heck the whitelist is supposed to be, you're stuck with blacklists. But let's assume you messed it up. Okay? Let's assume you haven't done your input validation perfectly. This is a safe assumption because you probably didn't. Is there anything else you can do to keep yourself from being completely screwed? Okay, so you're right, that's true. Input sanitization means making sure it's not bad. Input validation means making sure it's good. So you validate input to follow application-specific properties. If there's a name, the name should consist of alphanumeric character, because it doesn't make much sense for names to have dollar signs in them unless you're Kesha. Validation is. Sanitization is saying let's get rid of all the things that can lead to SQL injection. Yeah.
It seems like the more fundamental difference is that validation just looks and checks and says true or false, whereas sanitization actually changes the input to make it right.
That was my
true.
Like sanitization is escaping.
Right, that's true.
Or just removing.
Yeah. Yeah, validations. Well, the reason why I wouldn't strictly say it is because sometimes validation isn't necessarily just a true false thing. Sometimes you can actually mangle the input to make it validate. It's not strictly. No. It's like canonicalization. You know, making a canonical form, you know, like.
Oh, I see, like trimming it or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So sanitization is. Cleaning up your input, you do it for reasons other than just sanitizing it. And input validation, you're right, normally is a Boolean operation, is it valid or not. But more generally, when you will canonicalize your input and then make sure it's valid. So it's kind of, yes? So, that's a question.
Yeah.
Do you think your client code could be fooled by a rogue server? Maybe. Remember the whole intruder in the middle, someone injecting stuff in the middle of your application? Yeah. But in general, client-side checking of server inputs is generally much less because the client is ephemeral. You just have downloaded to the browser, it's doing some processing, and then sending it to the server. The server is where everything gets stored persistently, and so that's where you have to do most of your checks because that's where you're changing state in general. But it depends on your client. Some clients you may really want to do very careful checking.
Example is a lot of banks will show you a unique image when you log in so that you know you're actually connected to the right server.
Right. The security of that is marginal.
But it's an attempt.
But so stepping back, you've messed up input validation. The attacker is going to make your application do something bad. How do you make sure that the badness is contained, is limited in some way? How are you going to make sure you're not completely screwed by one line error in your application?
Mm-hmm.
Sandbox. So more generally, it's partitioning. Two things. Partitioning. Least privilege. So what that means at a high level is split your application into lots of little boxes and limit what the boxes can do to each other. So, for example, if you have part, let's say you have your web application here. So, what's this as? Here's Node. And here is your database. The easiest way to think of your app is just to say the database completely trusts Node. Node can do whatever it wants to the database. But what you can do is change the credentials with which Node logs into the database. Instead of it logging in with an administrative password, it can log in as a regular user most of the time. So what does that mean? It now has less of an ability to say, like maybe this user doesn't have the ability to drop tables. It doesn't have the ability to change the structure of the database. Maybe it might even have quotas on it that can only change so many records in a transaction. You can place all kinds of restrictions on the credentials that are used for the web application to log into the database. And you can even have the web application use different credentials under different contexts. It might be that if your web application is completely compromised, it might be able to grab the other credentials and then thus get access to it. But if it just manages to use an injection vulnerability by logging into the database with less privileges, you've limited the damage a rogue command to the database can do to it. So part of this partition because the node and the database are separate processes or separate programs, and then you're using least privilege, you're minimizing the privilege needed to do this. Because of course, your application will work just as well if you give it full administrative access to the database. You won't see any additional errors. But if you can minimize the use of the privileges you have when you do the operations, you'll be safer. You might even want to have different credentials per web user that Node takes on as it talks to the database. This also goes in your web application here. Does this run as one process or does it run as many processes? The classic thing that used to happen with Apache would that it would create an entire copy of its own process on every incoming connection. One nice thing about that is that separate child process, if it gets compromised in any way, won't affect the main server. It'll just affect that child. And if that child has reduced its privileges before actually processing the input, it can do less damage to the system. This is a classic model. Create a copy of yourself. Make yourself as little privilege, give yourself as little privileges as possible to do what that particular request was, then do the operation. When you're running a node, you normally are just using one process, you're not using multiple threads, you're not multiple processes, it's just one thing. Well, you still can do this sort of strategy if you need to do any sort of serious processing, some sort of serious input from the user, you can fork it off to another process. Let's say you want to do some image analysis. Don't do it inside your node process. It's a bad idea anyway. You fork off another process, have it run as an unprivileged user. Give it limited access to files. That way, it can't overwrite your entire file system if it messes up. For most of your apps, normally when you just get into bigger apps, you'll have to do these sort of things. But again, it depends. All of you guys are building stuff that handles user input. How paranoid do you want to be about this? It depends, but you can see it can take arbitrary amounts of work to start doing this. And it doesn't make your application run any faster. It doesn't give you any more features. Doing this will probably break your application for a time.
Does it give you more marks?
I will definitely give you style points if you've tried to do least privilege. that'll be something that will impress me. If you try to do some sort of least privilege setup. But I'm not expecting it. I'm so not expecting it. But if you, that's why that's, yeah. But again, it should be something that is appropriate. Making things more complicated just for more for its own sake is not good, because complexity makes card harder to understand, it makes it harder to audit, it's harder to find bugs, and probably makes your system overall less secure than it would be otherwise. So this is the server side stuff. Oh, I'm going to start talking a little about client side, but there's one other piece I need to put in here, which is anyone know about same origin policy? Huh? What? Pain, and it's mostly dead. I kind of see with HTML5 and all the other things, I see same origin policy. It's kind of mostly gone. I'm not seeing much of it anymore, which worries me.
Sucks.
So let me explain what this is. Same. Anyone know what same origin policy is?
Only serve to pages that came also from your server.
So, okay.
If you're on a domain, you can't load files from a different domain.
So same, basically. Kind of. So, this all started with Java applets. That's where same origin policy was first created. So the idea there is you would download Java code as an applet to your browser, and it would run in your browser. So now you should be thinking, whoa, I just downloaded a full Java program into this, you know, into a browser. How could that possibly be secure? Well, first off, Java applets had a sandbox. Which has holes. But, yeah, it's all sandboxes have holes. It's a question of whether people have found them yet. So, the idea was it would be running the sandbox, which means the Java applet would not be able to access your local machine. It wouldn't be able to access arbitrary files. It wouldn't be able to access your memory or other things. It's restricted. The question the folks at Sun had, though, was, okay, we've restricted... How can access the local machine? How should we restrict its network connections? So first off, you need to think, why do I care about restricting network connections? Because it's someone else's box, right? I've got the web, I've downloaded this Java applet. If it's talking on the network to other things, it's not talking to my box. My box is still safe. The sandbox protects it. Why can't I let it just talk to the world? What could you do with code that's downloaded to a random machine on the internet that has arbitrary network access?
Botnet.
You've described a botnet. It could send spam email on your behalf. It could try to... If it was on an intranet, it could scan the intranet looking for interesting servers, do surveillance, and then send it off. I mean, it's the equivalent of taking a random computer and plugging it into your network and seeing what it will do to your network, i.e. almost anything. And so if you think of that, you go like, ooh, that sounds like a really bad idea. The Sun folks said, okay, no. If we're going to download code to the web browser and it's going to run there, it cannot talk to the arbiter to anywhere in the network. All it should be able to do is talk to the origin server. Wherever the code was downloaded, it will have unrestricted access to talk to that page. Because the code came from there, it can talk back to home. But it can't talk to anywhere else. That's what same origin policy is. It's a restriction on code downloaded to the web browser, preventing where it can connect on the internet. The restriction was originally there for Java applets, and it's also there for JavaScript. But it's kind of broken for JavaScript. The parts that... So if you... So if you're doing classic Ajax, and you're using XML HTTP request, you're supposed to be talking XML on the network. This follows same origin policy. So this XML can only go to the origin server. But remember, we're in the web page. Right? So if we're in a web page, we can download stuff. You know, we might not be able to do XML from anyone else, but what can I do from any other server on the internet? Load an image. Load JavaScript. So the way same origin gets manifested in JavaScript is things you load from other servers are opaque. You can't mess with them. And things you load from your origin server, you can do some queries into them. But that's not strictly true, because you can load JavaScript from arbitrary parts of the internet, and when you load the JavaScript, it just gets loaded into the JavaScript context. This is a key reason why everyone uses JSON now instead of XML. JSON is just JavaScript. So you load JavaScript from arbitrary things. So JSON does not follow same origin policy. There are no restrictions on where you can load JSON from. This is why I was saying same origin policy is largely being bypassed on today's internet in various ways. And in the HTML5 standards, there's various ways in which they're getting rid of it. Now, there are some alternatives for same origin policy that are being proposed, and they're in early stages, and I will might be able to talk about them. I might be able to talk about them now. I have some time now, but we'll see. But I have a couple of things I've talked about first. But this is all about preventing code that comes down to your browser from being used as a botnet or, you know, some sort of scanning tool or whatever, sending spam. That's what same origin policy was supposed to prevent against. And as we loosen the restrictions of what JavaScript and the client can do, we now are enabling all those really bad things, like WebSockets. If there aren't some restrictions on WebSockets, the kind of bad things you can do is just rather large. So I can talk about same origin policy, otherwise I want to talk about the other attacks that I haven't talked about yet. Did I just erase them? I think I did.
Oh well. Shell injection across
the screen. So the shell stuff and the SQL injection. Shell injection is the same as SQL injection, except that you send a shell command to the server instead of a SQL injection command.
So even more fun.
Yeah. So.
Instead of just drop table, you have rm star.
Yes, rm-rf slash.
Johnny RM.
So, but the other ones are, I kind of want to end by trying to explain cross-site scripting. Yes?
Under what condition? Same idea is if you're taking unsanitized user input and just passing it around, it might get interpreted as a function and thus run the...
For example, let's say you're spawning an external process. Let's say you're generating a command line to run a utility, say to sort a file or to process an image. And so now you're building up the string that you're going to give to a shell to run. Well, if you aren't very careful in what you give that shell, you've just allowed the attacker to run arbitrary shell commands on your server.
That would be passing some snippet that came from the client.
Right, but oftentimes you're having to do some sort of, you know, exactly. That's the whole thing about making sure you aren't putting that on the input. Maybe say, oh, I just got a file from them. What's the file name? Oh, it's whatever file name they gave me. Oh, let me put that file name in the command line. As opposed to, say, taking the file name they gave you, remembering it, and then making up a completely new file name for it, and using that on the server. That is, like, you could hash it. That is one way to do it. But you could also just give it a completely random name and associate it with it with the string. And this, so that string that they gave you as the name, you might want to report it back, but you never use it on your server for anything. It never gets passed to the parser that is your shell interpreter. See, protect the shell interpreter. Protect the interpreter. Protect the parser. Because you don't know what you're telling it to do.
So now let's talk about...
what board am I going to raise?
Oh, this one. So what's cross-site scripting?
So the category, as I said, is not well defined. To a first approximation, it's client-side JavaScript injection. That's what you should in general. I mean, the reason why it's not strictly that is because there's some things with, you can use dynamic HTML as part of the thing you inject, and you can do other things with it. But in general, it's mostly client side . So how do you do it?
Add loads up. It has an override for submit on click.
So add's a little funny. The add is there, but you've actually normally inputted the add into your page, so it's not quite an attack. It's more of an abuse of trust. You said, I'm going to load the JavaScript from the add and put it in my application, and if it's bad JavaScript, well...
Also, I'm not to say if it just proxies and it's actually doing an iframe and things around the website
access
here or there.
No, I'm thinking more of like a comment box. You're allowed to type in something. You type in some text. It gets submitted to the server, and the server generates a page using that input. What if you put JavaScript in here? More importantly, what if you put a script tag in there? So you say, script. JavaScript. Because the naive way of doing this would be you take the comment, you store it on the server, and you're not going to parse it on the server. You're just going to store it. Then you stick it into the middle of the web page where you say, oh, here's comment here, make some divs. This comment goes here in that nice little box, and then send it to the client. The parser that's going to be exploited is the parser in the browser. The server, in a sense, isn't compromised. The security flaw is in the server because it's sending a bad web page to the client, but the server itself is not really being compromised. It's storing the attack. The attack is being, the exploit's happening in the browser. So an attacker does this, you know, submits a bad comment. Then anyone else, say, viewing the comments, say, viewing the blog post, now will run this code. And this code could do who the heck knows what. You may go like, well, what do you mean? I'm just visiting a random blog.
What could it do? Well, JavaScript in a random blog can potentially send... this gets into another thing called cross-site request forgery, which I'll talk about in a second. But this is bad because, first off, it's going to mess up your application. Let's say this comment just does something like erase all the other comments. You know, this is JavaScript. It could completely change the page. Replace all the pictures with pictures of Barney. So at the very bare minimum, it can deface your page. It can make your page untrustworthy. And it may be able to actually compromise confidential information. Like, let's say on the same page as this, there is a password box. Password input box. They could compromise that now and capture your password. It's all, you know, one thing. Or maybe they change the links. So now instead of you visiting where you thought you were, you're visiting some attacker's website. I mean, think about all the ways you can make a web page different. You can do all of that from JavaScript, and you do all of that once it's injected.
Gmail, a long time ago, was hit by that. And there was cookie theft. How would cookie theft occur?
How would cookie theft occur?
Yeah. Like, it basically... the code was somehow able to, through cross-site scripting, obtain authorization as...
Right.
Like, pass on whatever the identity bits were required to log in.
Right. So, it's a bit technical, but there are ways to do things so that you make it seem like it's going to one site, but it's actually going to another site, and so you get the cookies for one, and then the other cookies go from to another site, and so... when you start going into exactly how these attacks work, it gets into a lot of very detailed specifics. Like normal nowadays, modern browsers, you shouldn't be able to do cookie theft in those kind of ways now that you could before. But that's because certain little thing you weren't supposed to be able to do, and then there were some little exceptions which allowed you to do it, and those have been locked down. And when you start getting into the details of any attack on modern systems, you realize, whoa, you have to do that, and you have to do that, and there's this thing that protects you, and there's... It's hard to understand it all. And so, as a regular developer, you shouldn't even try to understand all the attacks. Because you shouldn't be trying to prevent them in a specific way. If you think of these more general principles, you realize, oh, that's what I need to do. It's like, okay, how do you do this now? This, again, there's a parser that you have to protect. It's a client-side parser. But the only thing that can protect it is really on the server. Because you're going to take this, it's going to be submitted to the server, and then the server is going to use it to generate a new web page using the user's content. The blacklist, remember we talk about blacklist versus whitelist? The blacklist approach says, well, if it says script, then don't let it go. Delete that. Turns out there's lots of ways of doing script. There's not just one way. And you can do weird things like split it up. Like you can do script and have another thing in the middle of it, and when you break it. The number of ways of encoding it, or you could use it as an attribute tag off a HTML tag. Or the number of ways you can inject JavaScript into a web page is rather large. And finding patterns for all of those in your web page using regular expressions is really hard too. Because that's what they often attack when they go after your blacklist. They go after the regular expression pattern that you used to try to capture these things. Yes?
Yeah, just snip out all the angle brackets and use Markdown for formatting.
This is actually the main reason why most apps, you know, nowadays modern blogging apps and stuff like that, don't want you to enter arbitrary HTML into a page for a comment. They give you the easier way to do security is to do it using another formatting language. Because see, if you say no angle brackets, okay. But see, a lot of times they say, oh, you can't do these tags. You can use angle brackets, but just don't only use these. Don't only, you know, like, you can put an A tag in, and you can use a, you know, bold, and you can use italics and stuff like that. You can do that, but you can't do anything else. Exactly. If you didn't do your blacklist just right and you miss some case and your regular expression has one flaw in it or something, yeah, you're getting past that. Which is why they now instead want to say, use Markdown or Textile or other things. These other ways of doing input which are inherently limited. You now run them through a parser during the web page, but the parser language is limited. It doesn't let you do arbitrary things. Although I kind of wonder with things like Markdown now and stuff like that, they've become very rich. So I almost wonder if they're maybe too powerful. I have not heard about Markdown exploits.
It's pretty small.
See, you're assuming that all Markdown follows the main Markdown spec, too. What features did they add? Exactly.
Spec.
Exactly. Yeah.
Some guy's blog post from 5 years ago in a Perl script.
Exactly. Perl script. Parsing.
There's actually young bugs in that script.
Yeah. So there's other implementations, and maybe some, and I've seen things with this Markdown plus some other things. They wanted to add some functionality. It's like, what functionality did they add? Did they just add a vulnerability? I don't know.
That's an arms race, though, right?
No, but the point I was making earlier was that parsers are the danger. Anything you hand to a parser is potentially something that can blow up in your face. And you want to minimize what you send to a parser. And if you're going to send to a parser, make sure you know exactly what you're sending to the parser. And programmers keep forgetting this, that like I want a parser that does less, not a parser that does more. Oh, that's a bad pun. But... But that's not how we tend. You know, everyone wants it to do more.
So. What are the ethics around sanitization of queries that you're just passing proxying through APIs?
Ethics?
Well, I mean,
who's going to whack you? I mean, in some sense, the other guys have to. It depends on how much trust they have in you. I mean, basically, are they good? You know, should they be able to filter it, or are they giving you some special privileges, and so you're getting trouble? So, the more privileges you have, the more responsibility you have for not giving bad stuff.
Public API to a major.
Even a public API depends on what sort of privileges you have. I mean, you generally have to authenticate to those things, and remember, it might be your money at stake. You might be have a credit card attached to those credentials. So anyway, there's more. I'll talk about other defenses and things on Thursday. But just the thing you should think about is try to do security. Try to make basic design decisions in how you do things to make this easier for yourself in the context of your application. But yes, you're going to mess up, and plan for that too.